Of the many campaigns fought in the Civil War, none was so grueling, so tiring, or so bloody as the Overland Campaign of 1864. For 6 weeks, the Union Army of the Potomac, led by Generals Ulysses S. Grant and George Gordon Meade, and the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, led by General Robert E. Lee, maneuvered, marched, and battled their way through central Virginia before finally settling down to a grinding 10-month-long siege at Petersburg. On the way, they engaged in 4 major battles. This tour will guide you on a tour of the second and most bloody of those encounters, the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse. Hi, my name's Donald Fonts. I'm the staff historian at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. For the next 3 hours or so, I'd like to lead you on a tour of Spotsylvania. When driving this tour, refer to the verbal instructions on this podcast, ignoring any round, brown, and white battlefield tour signs that you might see. They follow a different tour. One word of caution, portions of this tour follow heavily traveled public roads. When on these roads, maintain the proper speed and use your turn signals. Now, if you're ready, let's begin our tour. By 1864, the American Civil War was entering its 4th year. Gettysburg was in the past, as were Vicksburg, Chattanooga, and Chancellorsville. The bloody battles waged at Shiloh, Antietam, and Bull Run were now but distant memories. And still the war dragged on. Northern armies had made some progress in 1863, but the outcome of the war was anything but certain. One thing, however, was certain. Many more men would have to die before the conflict ended. But would Northern citizens tolerate more bloodshed? 1864 was an election year in America. In November, war-weary Northerners would go to the polls to decide whether to retain Abraham Lincoln as president or to elect in his place a candidate dedicated to ending the conflict by negotiation. Lincoln had just 6 months to show the Northern people that the war could and would be won. For that, he needed victories, specifically victories in the East, in Virginia. To secure those victories, Lincoln turned to Ulysses S. Grant. In 3 years of fighting, Grant had defeated Confederate armies at Fort Donelson, Shiloh, Vicksburg, and Chattanooga. Lincoln recognized the Midwesterners' ability, and in March 1864, he appointed Grant General-in-Chief, putting him in charge of the entire Union war effort. Leaving his friend William Tecumseh Sherman to manage affairs in Tennessee, Grant came east to Virginia. For the final year of the war, he would make his headquarters with General George Gordon Meade's Army of the Potomac, in effect making Meade's army his own. Grant led the Army of the Potomac across the Rapidan River in May, attacking Lee in the brush-choked thickets of the Wilderness. The casualties there were staggering. In 2 days of brutal combat, the Union Army lost nearly 18,000 men. Lee lost perhaps 11,000. Most generals would have retreated in the face of such losses, but not Grant. On May 7th, he ordered Meade's troops out of the Wilderness and set them on the road to Spotsylvania Courthouse. Control of Spotsylvania and its roads would place Grant squarely between the Army of Northern Virginia and Richmond. In order to protect his capital, Lee would have to either outmarch Grant to Richmond, using a longer system of roads, or attack his army in an effort to push it aside. Either way, Grant would have a big advantage. The Army of the Potomac left the Wilderness with about 85,000 men. Of those, about 10,000 were in General Philip Sheridan's cavalry. The rest belonged to one of Meade's 3 infantry corps. General Winfield Hancock commanded the Army's 2nd Corps, Gouverneur Warren, its 5th, and General John Sedgwick, its 6th. Not a part of Meade's army, but acting in tandem with it, was General Ambrose Burnside's 9th Corps. Burnside's corps raised the number of Union soldiers at Spotsylvania to 100,000 men. General Robert E. Lee could only dream of such numbers. Following the Battle of the Wilderness, his army counted just 54,000 muskets, a little more than half the number of his foe. Although some of his men belonged to General Jeb Stuart's cavalry, most were foot soldiers. Lee had 3 infantry corps in his army, led by Generals Richard Anderson, Richard Ewell, and Jubal Early. Of those 3, only Ewell had been in charge of a corps at the beginning of the campaign, 4 days earlier. Anderson and Early had taken command of their respective corps on the march to Spotsylvania, replacing officers who had become incapacitated during the fighting in the Wilderness. How well Lee's generals would respond to the demands of the campaign remained to be seen. Now, let's head toward the battlefield. If you're beginning your tour at the Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center, leave the parking lot by the exit closest to the building, turn left, and proceed to Route 3. Turn right on this busy road and get into the left-hand lane. In 1.1 miles, you'll come to Route 621, the Orange Plank Road. turn left and follow the road 2 miles to the stop sign at Route 613, the Brock Road. Turn left at the stop sign and follow 613 south for 4.6 miles when you'll come to a small parking area with historical signs on the right side of the road. Park there, facing the road. If you're coming directly from the Wilderness Battlefield, start at the intersection of Route 613 and Route 621, the Brock Road-Plank Road intersection. Turn right onto the Brock Road, Route 613, and drive 4.6 miles to the Todd's Tavern parking area, which will be on your right. Once you reach Todd's Tavern, park facing the road and turn your player back on. If you're already at Spotsylvania Battlefield, go back to where you entered the park, at Route 613, and turn right. Drive 3.7 miles to Todd's Tavern and pull into the exhibit area on the left side of the road. Once again, turn and stand so that you're facing the road. Stop number 1, Todd's Tavern. Step out of your vehicle and face the road. You're now at the site of Todd's Tavern, a large, white, clapboard building that stood on the Brock Road about midway between the Wilderness Battlefield, to your left, and Spotsylvania Courthouse, to your right. The Union Army used the Brock Road to march to Spotsylvania. Here, at Todd's Tavern, however, 2,000 Confederate horsemen under General Fitzhugh Lee barred the way. Meade ordered his cavalry chief, General Philip Sheridan, to drive Lee away from Todd's Tavern and clear the Brock Road all the way to Spotsylvania Courthouse. But Sheridan failed in his task. Although he forced the Confederates to abandon Todd's Tavern, Lee simply took up a new position closer to Spotsylvania. Rather than pursue him, Sheridan went into camp at Todd's Tavern. When Grant and Meade arrived here at midnight, May 8th, they learned that Lee's men still blocked the road. In a fury, Meade rousted Sheridan's troopers from their sleep and put them to work. He sent some of them west out the Tarpon Road to guard against an advance by the Confederate Army in that direction. The rest he sent south, down the Brock Road, to clear the way to Spotsylvania Courthouse. 2 miles down the Brock Road, to your right, Sheridan collided with Lee's horsemen, who were sheltered behind a log barricade that they had thrown across the road. The Union horsemen dismounted. Fighting on foot, they drove Lee's men away from the barricade and pushed them down the Brock Road toward Spotsylvania Courthouse. But it was slow going, and Meade was in a hurry. With growing impatience, he ordered Sheridan's men to step aside and sent General Gouverneur K. Warren's 5th Corps ahead to clear the road. Warren's foot soldiers overpowered the Confederate horsemen and sent them scampering to the rear. At 8 a.m., the general informed headquarters, "The opposition to us amounts to nothing as yet. We are advancing steadily. If there is nothing but cavalry, we shall scarcely halt." We'll return to the battle in a moment, but first let's visit Spotsylvania Courthouse. To reach the town, turn right out of the parking lot and follow the Brock Road for 5.6 miles to your second stoplight. As you head south, you'll be using the same road traveled by Warren's weary soldiers on May 8th. On the way, you'll pass the entrance to Spotsylvania Battlefield. Ignore the battlefield for now. We'll return to it presently. When you reach the stoplight at Spotsylvania Courthouse, turn left onto the Fredericksburg Road, Route 208, and then turn left again into the first large parking lot that you see. Step out of your vehicle, walk over to the small brick plaza near the pedestrian crosswalk, and face the stoplight. Stop number 2, Spotsylvania Courthouse. You're now at Spotsylvania Courthouse, the goal of the Union Army's march. Spotsylvania was a village of no more than a dozen buildings in 1864. Although it has grown considerably in recent years, most of the Civil War structures still survive. Ahead of you, beyond the stoplight, is Sanford's Hotel. The building on your left, with the large columns, is the old courthouse. Between the hotel and the courthouse, on the courthouse lawn, is the old jail. And just around the corner from the jail are three Civil War-era churches. While Warren was slowly making his way south along the Brock Road, General James Wilson approached the town by way of the Fredericksburg Road, on your left. Wilson commanded a small Union cavalry division, numbering about 3,000 men. Unlike the Brock Road, the Confederates had no significant force guarding the Fredericksburg Road, and Wilson's men were able to seize the town without a fight. Holding it was another matter. As Confederate infantry began pouring in from the west, your right, Wilson had to relinquish his prize and fall back toward Fredericksburg. Although the armies remained at Spotsylvania Courthouse for the next 2 weeks, Union cavalry did not play a significant role in the battle. In fact, for most of that time, it wasn't even here. On May 9th, Grant sent Sheridan and his troopers, 10,000 strong, on a raid toward Richmond. The purpose of the raid was to draw General Jeb Stuart's Confederate cavalry into a fight and destroy it. Although Sheridan failed to wipe out Stuart's cavalry, he did succeed in mortally wounding Stuart himself, at a place called Yellow Tavern, just outside of Richmond. It was the Third Corps commander Lee had lost in a week. We'll now head back to Spotsylvania Battlefield. To do that, turn right out of the parking lot, proceed to the stoplight, and turn right onto the Brock Road, Route 613. Drive 1.8 miles and turn right onto the Park Tour Road, Grant Drive. A large brown sign marks the entrance to the park. After you make the turn, you'll see the Spotsylvania Battlefield Exhibit Shelter on the left. Park your vehicle at the exhibit shelter and walk back to the Brock Road. Stand near the stop sign at the intersection and face south toward the field visible across the road. Stop number 3, Spotsylvania Exhibit Shelter. One of Robert E. Lee's greatest attributes as a general was his ability to discern the intentions of his opponents. When Grant did not renew his attacks after 2 days of fighting in the wilderness, Lee concluded that he was preparing to move. Grant had two courses open to him. He could either advance to Spotsylvania Courthouse or retreat toward Fredericksburg. Either way, Lee was determined to intercept him. General Richard Anderson commanded the Confederate Army's First Corps, in place of James Longstreet, who had been wounded in the wilderness. On May 7th, Lee ordered Anderson to lead Longstreet's corps to Spotsylvania Courthouse. If Grant was headed to Spotsylvania, Lee hoped that Anderson would head him off. On the other hand, if Grant was falling back to Fredericksburg, Anderson might be in a position to intercept the Union column on its march. Lee ordered Anderson to rest his troops in the wilderness and start for Spotsylvania no later than 3 a.m. on May 8th. To reach Spotsylvania, Anderson would use a military road cut through the woods by Confederate engineers. As soon as night descended on the battlefield, Anderson withdrew his troops from the front. Around him, the woods were on fire. Unable to find a comfortable place to rest his men, Anderson decided to march to Spotsylvania first and then rest his troops once he got here. Because of that decision, his corps was just 2 miles from Spotsylvania Courthouse on May 8th when word arrived from Jeb Stuart that the Union Army was marching on the town. Anderson rushed forward to block the Federal advance. While two of his brigades hurried to the courthouse to chase away Wilson's division, the rest of his corps reinforced Fitzhugh Lee's, whose men were hastily throwing up earthworks on a ridge just outside of town. That ridge, now known as Laurel Hill, is 1/4 mile ahead of you on the far side of the field. Anderson reached Laurel Hill in the nick of time. As his troops fell into line along the ridge, Warren's corps pulled up here on the opposite side of the field. General John Robinson's division led the way. Unaware the Confederate infantry was in his front, Warren ordered Robinson's weary, dust-choked soldiers to charge. "Never mind bullets," he barked. "Never mind cannon. Press on and clear this road." Sarah Spindle lived directly in the path of the Union advance. She was just sitting down to breakfast with her children when she heard the rattle of musketry outside her door. Suddenly, Union sharpshooters burst into her house. Running upstairs, they threw open her windows and began firing at Confederates across the field. In response, Confederate artillery shelled the house, setting it on fire. Scared out of her wits, Sarah Spindle grabbed her children and fled the burning building. She would never return. Robinson, meanwhile, began his advance across the field. When his men got within a couple hundred yards of the Confederate line, musketry tore through their ranks. The line lurched to a halt and returned fire. As Robinson struggled to get his men moving again, a bullet shattered his knee. The division continued forward without its leader, but it was repulsed and fell back to this point. Undeterred, Warren continued his attacks. Rather than mass his corps for one powerful assault, however, he threw his divisions in one at a time. Anderson's men, fighting from the cover of hasty earthworks, were able to beat back each assault. At sunset, John Sedgwick's VI Corps reinforced Warren at Laurel Hill. In one last effort to reach Spotsylvania, Meade ordered Sedgwick to move through the woods to your left and outflank Anderson's line. Southern reinforcements reached the battlefield about the same time, however, and drove Sedgwick's men back. The Confederates had won the race to Spotsylvania Courthouse. The Army spent the following day, May 9th, fortifying their positions. Warren's corps dug in opposite Laurel Hill, to your right front, with Sedgwick extending the Federal line to your left rear. As the Union troops entrenched, Confederate sharpshooters shot at them from across the field. Some of the sharpshooters used special rifles, equipped with high-powered sights. Although staff officers admonished Sedgwick to stay clear of the road, he later wandered over to the road to straighten out some confusion among the troops. As he was giving instructions, a bullet whizzed past his ear, prompting a young soldier to take cover. Sedgwick tapped the man gently with his foot and said, "Why, my man, I'm ashamed of you dodging that way. They couldn't hit an elephant at this distance." Just then, a second shot was heard, and then a third, the latter followed by a sickening thud. Sedgwick fell backward, blood gushing from a wound just below his left eye. He was the highest-ranking Union officer to die in the war. A monument marking the spot of Sedgwick's death stands just behind you. Take a look at it on the way back to your car. Before leaving the stop, I encourage you to take a few minutes to read the panels at the exhibit shelter. They provide a good overview of the battle. When you're ready to continue your tour, turn left out of the parking lot and drive 0.6 miles to a stop on the right called Upton's Road. Remain in your vehicle. Stop number 4, Upton's Road. On May 9th, while his troops entrenched, Grant probed the flanks of the Confederate Army looking for a point of attack. When reconnaissances indicated that both ends of Lee's lines were secure, Grant concluded that the area in between must be weak. On May 10th, he issued orders for a general assault against the center of the Confederate line. General Horatio Wright spearheaded the assault. Wright had taken command of the Sixth Corps following Sedgwick's death. Meade ordered him to attack the Confederate center near the McCool House, aided by General Gershom Mott's division of the Second Corps. To support Wright's attack, the Union commander ordered Hancock and Warren to attack Laurel Hill on the right, and Burnside to charge down the Fredericksburg Road on the far left. The attacks were to begin promptly at 5 p.m. Poor communication and a lack of teamwork doomed the effort to failure. Warren, imagining that he saw an opportunity for success at Laurel Hill, made his attack an hour ahead of schedule and was defeated. His repulse prompted Grant to push the general assault back 1 hour to 6 p.m. Unfortunately, no one informed Mott of the change. At 5 p.m., Mott's division charged the center of the Confederate line, 1/2 mile to your left front, and was routed. Burnside attacked at the correct hour, but his half-hearted effort accomplished little. That left just Horatio Wright's Sixth Corps, which Meade had assigned to strike the center of the Confederate line. An ambitious 25-year-old colonel named Emory Upton led the assault. Upton's skirmishers crept through these woods on the afternoon of May 10th, pushing Confederate skirmishers back to their main line, 300 yards to your right front. Once he had this area under his control, Upton advanced 5,000 men down the narrow woods road, visible just behind the sign, and quietly deployed them in the trees just 200 yards from the Confederate line. To reach the enemy, the Federals would have to charge across an open field and surmount a line of breastworks, all the while under a heavy fire. It was enough to make the stoutest heart tremble. At 6 p.m., Upton gave the order to advance. "I felt my gorge rise," remembered one man, "and my stomach and intestines shrink together in a knot, and 1,000 things rushed through my mind. I fully realized the terrible peril I was to encounter. I looked about in the faces of the boys around me, and they told the tale of expected death. Pulling my cap down over my eyes, I stepped out." To reach Dole Salient, the object of Upton's attack, follow the Park Tour Road 0.3 mile, when it will make a sharp turn to the right. Continue along the road for 0.2 mile farther, then pull over to the right, opposite the signs. A lone white sycamore tree marks the spot. If you reach the cannons, you've gone too far. Once you reach Dole's Salient, step out of your car and face the signs. The tour road should be behind you. Stop number 5, Dole's Salient. When the Army of Northern Virginia arrived at Spotsylvania Courthouse on May 8th, it constructed 6 miles of trenches stretching from the Po River on the left to Spotsylvania Courthouse on the right. The center of the line featured a huge outward bulge or salient, 1/2 mile wide and 3/4 mile deep. Because of its shape, soldiers dubbed that part of the line the Mule Shoe Salient. Salients are by nature difficult positions to defend. They are subject to crossfire from enemy guns, and if overrun, they collapse like overblown bubbles. Lee recognized the Mule Shoe Salient's weakness, but thought it necessary to hold the high ground on which it rested. He ordered Ewell's Corps to dig in and defend the line as best it could. Within 48 hours, Ewell's men had constructed a head-high, earthen log barricade capable of stopping bullets and artillery shells. The remnants of that once formidable line are visible immediately in front of you. This portion of the Mule Shoe Salient was held by a small brigade of Georgians commanded by General George Doles, probably no more than 1,000 rifles. On the afternoon of May 10th, Upton's skirmishers drove Doles' men out of the woods ahead of you and back to this line. At 5 p.m., Union artillery began to shell the Confederate line. Obviously, something was afoot. Ewell ordered Doles to reestablish his picket line, but before he could execute the order, Upton attacked. Surging out of the woods, the Union troops sprinted toward you across the field, pausing just long enough to tear away an obstruction of trees thrown down by Confederates to block their way. Ignoring the fire of Doles' men, the Union soldiers leaped over the works engaging the Confederates here in deadly hand-to-hand combat. The enemy sitting in their pits with pieces upright, loaded, and with bayonets fixed, ready to impale the first who should leap over, absolutely refused to yield the ground, remembered Upton. The first of our men who tried to surmount the works fell pierced through the head by musket balls. Others, seeing the fate of their comrades, held their pieces vertically, hurled them down upon the enemy, pinning them to the ground. The struggle lasted but a few seconds. Numbers prevailed, and like a resistless wave, the column poured over the works, quickly putting hors de combat those who resisted, and sending to the rear those who surrendered. Upton's attack was a glorious success. In just 20 minutes, he had breached the Confederate line, capturing more than 1,000 Confederate soldiers and two cannons. But that was to be the extent of his gains. Upton's superiors had not made any preparations to reinforce him. At sunset, Confederate reinforcements attacked him on all sides, forcing Upton to retreat. But though his attack ultimately failed, it got Grant to thinking. If 5,000 men could overrun the enemy line, what might 20,000 do? Continue straight ahead 1/2 mile to the end of the road, where you'll find a section of reconstructed log works. Step out of your vehicle and take a look at those works. Stop number 6, the reconstructed earthwork. The Union and Confederate armies constructed miles of earthworks at Spotsylvania. Today, the remnants of those defensive lines appear as small ridges, like the one you saw at your last stop. To help you understand what the lines looked like when they were new, the National Park Service has reconstructed this small section of Lee's line. To make these works, Confederate soldiers hewed down trees, cut off the limbs, and stacked the logs one on top of the other to form a 4-foot-tall barricade. Behind this, they dug a 3-foot-deep ditch. They banked dirt from that ditch against the outer face of the log works, creating an earthen parapet capable of stopping both bullets and shells. The parapet and the adjacent ditch together formed an earthwork tall enough that a man could stand up behind it without exposing himself to enemy fire. Once the main line was finished, soldiers added a head log. If you look at the reconstructed earthwork in front of you, you'll notice that there is a gap between the top log and the one below it. Soldiers purposely created that gap so that they could shoot at the enemy without exposing their heads. The top log was called a head log because it protected the soldiers' heads as they fired. At Spotsylvania, the Confederates also constructed a number of shorter log partitions known as traverses. Traverses were about 18 feet long and were spaced approximately 18 feet apart. They ran at right angles to the main earthwork, like teeth on a comb. Their purpose was to protect the defenders from hostile crossfire. Because of the mule shoe's unusual shape, Union artillery on the west side of the salient could actually fire into the backs of Confederate soldiers on the east side of the salient. To protect themselves from hostile fire coming at them from the rear, some Confederates built a fourth wall connecting the loose ends of the traverses that were on either side of them. They nicknamed the resulting enclosures hog pens. If you think of hog pens as a square, the main wall would be one side of the square, the back wall would be the opposite side of the square, and the traverses would be the sides connecting the two. The Confederates cleared the trees in front of the log works for a distance of up to 100 yards to create a field of fire, an open area where an attacking foe could not find cover. They then took the trees that they had cut down, sharpened the ends of the branches, and placed them out beyond the field of fire in a line facing the enemy. Called abattis, this row of fallen trees disrupted the momentum of the assault and threw the attackers into disorder. As the enemy fought to get past the woody obstruction, Confederate soldiers poured volley after volley into them at close range. To provide early warning of an attack, the Confederates posted sentries, known as pickets, several hundred yards in front of their lines. The pickets protected themselves by digging individual foxholes, which they called rifle pits. When the enemy advanced, the pickets would delay them as long as possible, and then retreat through the abattis to the main line of earthworks in their rear. By the time the Union line of battle reached the abattis, the Confederates, ensconced behind their crude but sturdy log works, would be ready and waiting for them. Upton's attack on May 10th succeeded in large part because his skirmishers pushed Confederate pickets back to the main line of earthworks long before the attack, allowing Upton to deploy his men unseen, just 200 yards from the Confederate line. When you're ready to continue the tour, get back in your car and return down the road. In 3/10 of a mile, you'll come to a fork in the road. Keep to your right. As soon as you pass the road fork, pull over to the edge of the road, stop, and put on your flashers. Stop number 7, the Harrison House. In the field to your right stood La Villa, the home of Edgar W. Harrison. Harrison owned 190 acres of land here at Spotsylvania, 70 of which he had under cultivation. 11 slaves farmed the land, producing corn, oats, and tobacco. Harrison was 35 years old in 1864. Like most men his age, he had joined the army, leaving his wife Anne to manage the farm in his absence. General Robert E. Lee visited the Harrison house often during the early stages of the battle. On May 10th, he directed Confederate counterattacks against Upton's force from the property, and he returned to the Harrison house again on May 11th to confirm with General Ewell. By then, the Union army was on the move. Upton's assault had convinced Grant that the Mule Shoe was vulnerable to attack, and he decided to hit it with everything he had. After dark, Grant withdrew Hancock's Second Corps from its position near the Po River on the Union right and concentrated it at the Brown House, north of the salient. It was a miserable march. Heavy rains lashed the countryside, turning the unpaved farm roads into rivers of deep, slippery mud. Back at the Harrison House, Lee received reports indicating that the Army of the Potomac was on the march. Some reports indicated that Grant might be trying to turn the Confederate left flank down by the Po River. Others indicated that he might be moving around Lee's right flank, toward Richmond. Still other reports suggested that he might be retreating to Fredericksburg. Whichever way Grant went, Lee had to be ready to follow him. But Ewell's artillery would make that difficult. To protect the center of his line, the general had bolstered the Mule Shoe salient with more than 30 cannon. There were no good roads inside the salient, and it would be hard to extricate the guns quickly when the army had to move. To save time, Lee ordered the cannons to be taken away from the front that night and moved to a point closer to Spotsylvania Courthouse. General Edward Johnson had no knowledge of Lee's order. Johnson commanded the Confederate forces that held the center of the Mule Shoe. At sunset, he noticed the cannons on his front moving to the rear. That worried him, because he knew that without artillery, the Mule Shoe was virtually indefensible. His concern grew even greater when pickets reported hearing Union soldiers massing near the Brown House. Returning to his headquarters at the McCool House, Johnson sent a staff officer to Ewell, urging him to return the guns. When Ewell hesitated to overturn Lee's orders, Johnson rode to Ewell's headquarters at the Harrison House and appealed to Ewell in person. His plea had its effect. At 1 a.m., Ewell sent a staff officer galloping toward Spotsylvania Courthouse with orders to return the missing guns at once. However, in the darkness, the courier lost his way, and it was 3:30 in the morning before the chief of artillery received the message. By then, daylight was just an hour away. The first guns reached the front just as Hancock's corps broke over the salient. Johnson's men tried to hold the Federals back, but in too many cases their damp weapons refused to fire. Within minutes, Hancock's corps had seized the salient, capturing Johnson, 3,000 of his men, and 22 of the 30 cannons that had been sent to support him. It was among the worst calamities ever to befall the Army of Northern Virginia. Lee heard the commotion and rode forward to investigate. To his mortification, he found the survivors of Johnson's division fleeing to the rear. Fortunately, Lee had reinforcements at hand. Near the Harrison House, General John Gordon had readied the brigades of his division to meet the Union onslaught. As he prepared to go forward, Lee appeared. Gordon probably heard how Lee had tried to lead the Texas Brigade into battle a few days earlier in the Wilderness, and he had no intention of letting his commander risk his life again. Riding up to Lee, Gordon called out in a voice loud enough for all to hear, "General Lee, this is no place for you. Go back, General. We'll drive them back. These men are Virginians and Georgians. They have never failed. They never will. Will you, boys?" With one voice, the soldiers shouted for Lee to go back to safety. "Go back, General Lee. We can't charge until you go back." "We'll drive them back, General." "General Lee to the rear. Lee to the rear." Before he could respond, a sergeant stepped from the ranks, grabbed Traveler by the reins, and pulled Lee to safety. With the commanding general out of the way, Gordon charged the Union line, driving the enemy like sheep before him. Continue forward just a short distance when you'll see a gravel road on your left leading to the McCool House. Drive to the end of the gravel road and stand at the signs you'll find there. Stop number 8, the McCool House. On May 12th, this farmhouse stood at the center of a military cyclone. The building and its surrounding 600 acres belonged to 50-year-old Neil McCool. Like his neighbor, Edgar Harrison, McCool raised corn, oats, and livestock on his farm, and like Harrison, he owned a small number of slaves. When McCool and his family fled the battlefield, General Edward Johnson occupied the abandoned structure and used it as his headquarters. Hancock's early morning assault shattered Johnson's division and threatened to sever the Army of Northern Virginia in two. Unless Lee could mend the line, and fast, his entire army might be cut to pieces. Grant realized the same thing. For the next 22 hours, each general threw every man he had into the fight. Grant fought to win, Lee to survive. The result was the most intense combat ever witnessed on this continent. As soon as he discovered that Grant had broken his lines, Lee ordered General John Gordon to recapture the lost works. Starting at the Harrison House behind you, Gordon's division swept north and east, retaking the right face of the Mule Shoe, 1/2 mile to your right. Lee, meanwhile, pulled brigades from other parts of his line and sent them against Union troops holding the salients left and center. General Stephen Dodson Ramsier commanded one of those brigades. Ramsier had orders to retake the trenches previously held by Doles' brigade. He formed his men here at the McCool House before charging Doles' works, which are just beyond the small monument visible in the field to your left rear. They captured dozens of Union soldiers. Among them were 5 Delaware boys, not more than 20 years of age. The Confederates took the boys' rifles and ordered them to the rear, but the boys refused to go, maintaining that they would be killed if they tried to cross the shell-swept field. The Southerners, however, insisted. Before the boys had gone 10 paces, each of them was dead. Minutes after Ramsier's attack, Brigadier General Abner Perrin led an attack against the center of the Union line, in the woods ahead. Before the battle, Perrin had vowed that he would emerge from the fighting a live major general or a dead brigadier. As his horse leaped over a line of breastworks, the ambitious general toppled from his saddle, his body pierced by 7 bullets. Although his brigade was routed, others followed. With each attack, the Confederates slowly chipped away at Hancock's gains. By late morning, the Union army held just a few acres of ground at the tip of the salient. Grant responded by putting in more troops. Throughout the morning, he and Meade funneled brigade after brigade into the salient, hoping to break the growing deadlock there. The fighting increasingly focused on a small turn in the Confederate works, a point later remembered as the Bloody Angle. Return to the paved road and turn right. Turn right again at your first opportunity, and proceed 0.4 mile, at which point the road makes a 90-degree turn to the left. After you make the turn, you'll see a parking area on your right. Stop there, get out of your vehicle, and walk over to the small cluster of historical signs. Stop number 9, the Bloody Angle. Visible across the field in front of you are 2 monuments marking the site of the Bloody Angle, the site of the most fierce, sustained fighting in American history. The angle got its name from the fact that the Confederate line turned slightly southward at that point, creating a noticeable angle in the log works. General Winfield Hancock successfully captured those works just after dawn on May 12th, his troops advancing across the fields in front of you, from left to right. For a short time, Hancock controlled everything within your view, but Confederate counterattacks soon reduced his hold on the salient to just a few acres. 1/4 mile ahead of you, John Gordon's Georgians recaptured the eastern face of the Mule Shoe salient, while less than 200 yards to your right rear, Stephen Ramsier's brigade recaptured the works held earlier by Doles' Georgia brigade. Hancock's troops still held the tip of the salient, however, including the small ridge on which the monuments now rest. From there, Union soldiers were able to fire down upon Ramsier's men to their right. The North Carolinians could not endure such punishment for long. If Lee had any hopes of regaining possession of the salient, he would have to capture the high ground on which the Bloody Angle rested. Between 6 and 10 a.m., he sent 3 brigades to take the ridge. The first, Abner Perrin's Alabama Brigade, was routed. The other 2, Nathaniel Harris's Mississippi Brigade and Samuel McGowan's South Carolinians, failed to drive Hancock from the salient, but they did manage to extend Ramsier's line as far as the angle itself. The Confederate counterattacks checked Hancock's momentum. In an effort to jumpstart the Union offensive, Grant ordered Horatio Wright's 6th Corps to reinforce Hancock at the salient, increasing the number of Union troops there to nearly 40,000 men. Wright's men came in on Hancock's right flank, here at the Bloody Angle. For the next 19 hours, Union and Confederate soldiers struggled over this small parcel of ground with a stubbornness and savagery unmatched during the war. Much of the combat was at close quarters. Soldiers stabbed one another through the gaps in the log works, brained one another with the butts of their weapons, and threw their bayonet-tipped rifles over the works like spears. The trenches ran red with human gore. Between attacks, Union soldiers found shelter in a small valley to the left of the monuments. From there, they kept up such a heavy fire that a 22-inch-wide oak tree at the angle crashed to earth, its trunk chipped to pieces by hundreds of bullets. When infantry fire failed to dislodge the Confederates, Union soldiers pushed 2 cannons forward to this vicinity and began firing rounds of canister into the southern line at a distance of just 300 yards. Confederate riflemen fired back, killing or wounding each of the horses attached to the cannons, and all but two of the gunners. When the battery commander sent additional horses forward to drag the guns to safety, they too were shot down. For the rest of the day, the cannon stood silent on the field. Lee couldn't maintain the contest at the angle indefinitely. After dark, he ordered his troops back to a new line beyond the Harrison House. In the morning, Union soldiers crept forward and took possession of the bloody angle. What they saw there shocked them. "The appalling sight presented was harrowing in the extreme," wrote Lieutenant Colonel Horace Porter. "Our own killed were scattered over a large space near the angle, while in front of the captured breastworks, the enemy's dead were piled upon each other in some places 4 layers deep, exhibiting every ghastly phase of mutilation. Below the mass of fast-decaying corpses, the convulsive twitching of limbs and the writhing of bodies showed that there were wounded men still alive and struggling to extricate themselves from their horrid entombment. Every relief possible was afforded, but in too many cases it came too late. The place was well named the Bloody Angle." Before leaving the stop, I strongly recommend that you take a walk over to the Bloody Angle, using the rubberized mulch trail that begins here at the parking lot and crosses the field. Please remain on the trail and don't walk on the earthworks. Once you're finished, get back in your car and head back in the direction of the McCool House. After passing Dole's Salient, however, take your first left and park at the Harrison House tour stop. Remain in your car and turn your player on. Stop number 10, Lee's last line. After abandoning the Bloody Angle, the Confederates fell back to a new line that Lee had constructed across the base of the salient. Remnants of that line lie in the woods 1/4 mile ahead of you, beyond the site of the Harrison House. You saw part of that line earlier at the reconstructed earthwork. Unwilling to attack Lee's new line, Grant began moving to your left toward the Fredericksburg Road. Lee countered by taking Anderson's corps from Laurel Hill on your right and moving it behind the rest of the army to a new position more than a mile to your left front, beyond Spotsylvania Courthouse. When Grant learned that Lee was withdrawing from this area, he doubled back, hoping that the sudden change in direction would catch the Confederates out of their trenches and force them to fight him in the open field. But the Confederates weren't to be caught napping. When Union troops advanced through this area on May 18th, they found Ewell's corps waiting for them behind stout earthworks, screened by a field of abatis 100 yards deep. The Union soldiers never even got close to the enemy line. As they emerged into the field, they came under the scathing blast of 29 Confederate cannon. The Northern soldiers hesitated and then broke for the rear. Union officers rallied them and returned to the attack, but with no better results. Realizing the futility of the endeavor, Grant canceled the assault and continued moving to the left. The action had cost him an additional 500 men. Turn left onto the paved road immediately in front of you and drive 1.3 miles to the Heath Salient tour stop. Remain in your car. Stop number 11, Heath Salient. While the Army of the Potomac was trading blows with Lee at Laurel Hill and at the Bloody Angle, General Ambrose E. Burnside's 9th Corps confronted Jubal Early's Confederates here on the eastern face of the Muleshoe Salient. Burnside didn't have a reputation for brilliance, and Spotsylvania did nothing to add to his laurels. Feeble attacks by Burnside on May 10th, 12th, and 18th pinned down enemy troops, but didn't seriously threaten the Confederate line. The most intense fighting in this sector occurred on May 12th during the fight for the Bloody Angle. After several hours of combat, affairs at the angle had reached an impasse. In an effort to break the deadlock, both Lee and Grant began searching for other avenues of attack. By coincidence, they both picked the same spot, a bulge on the eastern face of the Muleshoe, known as Heath Salient. The salient is in the woods to your right, approximately 300 yards away. Grant thought that Lee might have pulled troops from this area to reinforce men fighting at the angle. If so, Burnside might be able to overrun the weakened Confederate line, as Hancock had done earlier that morning. Lee, on the other hand, hoped that an attack on Burnside's left flank might relieve pressure on his troops fighting at the Bloody Angle. At 2 p.m., Burnside pushed forward 2 divisions, 8,000 men, to attack the southern line. To soften up the position, 9th Corps artillery fired on the Confederates from a position a few hundred yards to your left. Lee ordered Early to dispatch a force to capture the guns. In response, Early sent 2 brigades, perhaps 2,000 men, through the woods ahead of you to take the guns from the flank. As the Confederates moved through the woods, they unexpectedly encountered Burnside's infantry, which was advancing from your left to right through these woods to attack Heath Salient. A fierce hand-to-hand fight took place, resulting in several hundred casualties on each side. Hardest hit was the 17th Michigan Volunteers, which lost more than 207 men in the battle. The monument on your right commemorates the regiment's valor in this action. Continue down the Park Tor Road for 0.7 miles until you come to a tour stop for the Fredericksburg Road. Pull over there and restart your player, remaining in your car. Stop number 12, the Fredericksburg Road. Just ahead of you is the Fredericksburg Road, modern Route 208. This road leads from Fredericksburg, 9 miles to your left, to Spotsylvania Courthouse, 1 mile to your right. For 2 weeks, this quiet country road became one of the busiest thoroughfares in North America, as hundreds of wagons crowded onto its dirt surface, bringing food, clothing, and other supplies to the Union Army. Following his defeat at the Muleshoe Salient on May 18th, Grant shifted east toward the Fredericksburg Road. Anxious to know where his opponent had gone, Lee dispatched Ewell's Corps on a reconnaissance in force. 1.5 miles to your left, Ewell collided with General Robert O. Tyler's Heavy Artillery Brigade at the Harris Farm, also known as Bloomsbury. Ewell attacked. The heavies, as they were called, had been on duty in Washington, D.C. prior to that time and had no combat experience. Nevertheless, they stood their ground against Ewell's hardened veterans until reinforcements arrived to drive the Confederates away. The fighting at the Harris Farm cost Grant 1,500 men and added 500 names to Lee's casualty lists. Ambulances and wagons carried the wounded Union soldiers to temporary hospitals in the rear using the Fredericksburg Road. Those who couldn't find room in a wagon either rode on mules or made their way to the rear on foot. One doctor who witnessed the sad procession later wrote, "It was the most sickening sight of the war, this tide of the wounded flowing back. One has a shattered arm, and the sling in which he carries it is the same bloody rag the surgeon gave him the day of the battle. Another has a head seamed and bandaged so you can scarcely see it, and he weaves like a drunken man as he drags along through the hot sun. Another has his shoe cut off, and a great roll of rags wound around his foot, and he leans heavily on a rough cane broken from a pine tree. Another breathes painfully and holds his hand to his side, where you see the ragged rent in his blouse. Another sits by a puddle, dipping water on the wounded leg, which, for want of dressing since the battles, has become badly inflamed. Another lies on a plat of grass by the roadside, with his brown face turned full to the sun, and he sleeps. So I passed hundreds in riding a few miles. They move along silently, making no complaints, asking no questions, and no favors of the passerby. Such heroic bravery and fortitude are only surpassed by their valor on the field of battle." Continue forward to the intersection. At the stop sign, turn right onto Route 208, formerly known as the Fredericksburg Road. Drive to the first stoplight, turn left, and proceed 0.4 miles to Spotsylvania Confederate Cemetery on your left. Turn into the cemetery and park at a convenient spot. Stop number 13, Spotsylvania Confederate Cemetery. Despite 2 weeks of incessant fighting, victory had eluded Grant at Spotsylvania. With Lee firmly entrenched in his front, the Union commander decided to break off contact with the Confederates and push on to Richmond. On May 20th, he sent Hancock's 2nd Corps to Milford Station on the Richmond, Fredericksburg, and Potomac Railroad, deep in Lee's rear. With Hancock just 25 miles from the Confederate capital and threatening the Confederate Army's line of supply, Lee had no choice but to abandon his position at Spotsylvania and retreat southward. After 2 weeks of bitter fighting, the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse was over. The battle had been costly for both armies. At Spotsylvania, Grant lost more than 18,000 men killed, wounded, or captured. Originally interred on the battlefield, Union soldiers who died at Spotsylvania are now buried in a national cemetery in Fredericksburg. Lee's losses are unknown, but are thought to have been about 12,000 men. Of those who died, 600 are buried here at Spotsylvania Confederate Cemetery. The killing did not end at Spotsylvania. At North Anna River, Totopotomy Creek, and Cold Harbor, the armies collided again, adding thousands of new names to their already swollen casualty lists. By the time Grant reached Petersburg, he had lost 60,000 men, nearly as many soldiers as Lee had had in his entire army at the outset of the campaign. Over the same period, Lee lost approximately 40,000 men. Some members of the Northern press, shocked by the carnage, labeled Grant a butcher. But he knew what he was doing. He could replace his losses. Lee could not. Slowly, inexorably, Grant was grinding the Army of Northern Virginia down to the point where it could no longer resist. This concludes your tour. Once you're through visiting the cemetery, return to the Fredericksburg Road, Route 208, and turn right. Drive to the stoplight and turn right again. In 6 miles, you'll come to Route 1, the Jefferson Davis Highway. To reach Interstate 95, turn right onto the Jefferson Davis Highway and drive for a little over a mile. To go to Fredericksburg, stay on Route 208 and follow it for 4 miles into town.